I just want to thank the University of Colorado first for having me here. This is my rookie season, and this is my first panel. So try to imagine when you get your program and you see you're on a panel with Roger Ebert talking about creationism versus evolution.
Think how he feels.
Maybe we're in the same boat. But both these previous speakers have set up some of the things I want to talk about. My background is in music, science education. I'm a classically trained composer, and the last 7 or 8 years I've been working on New Age spirituality and the channeling phenomenon. So I just want to question the audience. How many people have heard about the channeling phenomenon or familiar with it in some sense? Okay, about half of you. How many people have heard of the author named Jane Roberts and the Seth phenomena? Okay. Well, okay, you've heard about that. That's interesting. That's something that we're working on, and our small company is called New Worldview, and we explore that. My work in this area has led me to question many different things, and that led me into different areas. And so what I've come up with is a position that I call integral conscious creation. It's not creationism, and it's hairy to be on this panel and use the word creation, but I think I can put it into play here. The conscious creation is basically the idea in the Seth material, coined by Jane Roberts, that you create your own reality. But upon further exploration of that idea, who is the you who's creating all of its reality? So it's a loaded question. And my research into this area has led me into developmental psychology and other areas. The integral part of this then provided a solution to open up the registers and try to get science into this, because I came from 10 years in a science museum and I love science. And so we're sort of a pro-science panel up here, so we hope there's some intelligent designers or creationists out there who will refute some of our points. Anyway, the integral approach is summarized by exploring body, mind, and spirit in self, culture, and nature. So I just want to put those ideas out there. Body, mind, spirit, self, culture, and nature. Now this panel is called Creationism versus Evolution. And it has its own bias, its own box that forces us into. I want to try and break us out of that box a little bit. And I want to now just pull back historically, briefly, and situate, as Chris and Roger have set up, creationism, the faith in the literal word of Scripture as absolute universal truth, is a pre-modern idea. And that comes to us from the mythic past, the medieval past, and that's in our Western heritage. There's other creation myths out there from all around the world. And you've heard of Joseph Campbell. I want to talk a little bit about creation myths in a little bit. We move into the modern era, the rise of science, and scholars argue what articulates the modern era, but I'm going to use Max Weber's separating the value spheres of art, morals, and science. That defines the modern era, just the arguments that I'm making. Art, morals, and science. So morals, morality, is where in the modern view religion fits into, because we have the Ten Commandments and other ethical things from our pre-modern past that are still in play. The title of this panel, Creationism versus Evolution, I want to add another versus what? Could there be yet another scientifically based creation myth in the works? And I think there is, and we'll just call that postmodern. Postmodernism then is really a reaction against modernism. So these value spheres are being critiqued as being inadequate in some way. So we'll get back to that. Now, Newton and Descartes, Newton formulated scientific method. Kepler and Galileo, these were the first guys to measure things and use numbers to describe that and then get together. Another important part of science is that it's a community of practice, and it is a lineage, very much like spiritual lineages. And so when scientists go a little too far and take their science as the only way of knowing what's true, we get into what's called scientism. And so there is a brand of evolutionism. I want to add ism onto evolution to consider in this discussion. There's authentic evolutionary scientific research going on, but there's also some really crazy bad science going on too. And maybe that pulls us back into intelligent design. What characterizes postmodernism? I use the word integral, body, mind, spirit, self, culture, and nature. Now let's look briefly at the pre-modern creation myth. What I agree, and I think I heard some agreement from the panelists, is that it says there is consciousness that creates somehow. In the modern era, science begins about 16 nanoseconds after the Big Bang, and Roger did a wonderful job of articulating the modern myth, as I see it, the modern story, based on the science that we know, because it's not final. We don't have all the answers yet. And that pushes us into this postmodern view that I just want to put out there as other possibilities for where some of these things are going and where this debate on, this inane debate perhaps on creationism versus others, but yet a very important one as far as educational policy and what's going on in the schools right now. Albert Einstein said that significant problems we face can never be solved at the level of thinking that created them. This is an evolutionary thought by an evolutionary thinker. So the pre-modern era had creationism, literal interpretation of Scripture. That told the story. That was it. We lived and we died, and that's how it went. The modern era spiraled into existence. Evolution is not linear. It is non-linear. There's linear elements we can look at, and I'm articulating modern and postmodern to just frame things. But evolution is not that clean. There's progressions and regressions. It's entirely possible, I'll just throw this out, that there's been a race of Homo sapiens that existed 500 million years ago that destroyed themselves on this planet. Until we find the fossil record to support that, we won't know. Now, the postmodern era is characterized by theories of everything. Stephen Hawking has a book called Theory of Everything, but it takes a physics point of view. And we're looking at physics to solve the theory of everything. Quantum mechanics is something that comes into the postmodern era, in my view, that moves science into postmodern science. Quantum mechanics is a weird, wacky world. It's counterintuitive, and it starts to get into spiritual areas. It starts to sound like spiritual sages and saints talking about their own direct experience with the divine. I want to talk a little bit then about myth. And I mentioned that Roger did a great job articulating the modern myth, and it does tail into postmodern myths too. And a myth is defined as an allegory narrative, a body of myths. This is from Webster's Online Dictionary, which I can't live without on my computer. So the Oxford sits in the other room, and I use the Webster's Online. A body of myths as a myth dealing with gods, demigods, legendary heroes of a particular people, or mythos. When we get into evolutionism, I characterize that as a mythos. It's no longer fully rational.
What is evolutionism?
Evolution is the belief that...
Evolutionism.
It's a belief system.
Give me an example of what an evolutionismist would say.
That this, basically, it's a law. Science works, starts on a hypothesis, as you mentioned, develops into theory, with a lot of evidence, and evolution has a lot of evidence behind it. But when scientists start dealing with their theory as a law, this is it, this explains all, whether it's in biology, neurology, these different disciplines, it gets into, it's not accurate. So evolutionism is the belief that it's a law or an absolute truth, when in fact it can be proven that it's not. Through scientific method, in a community of people doing the same research. Okay, I don't want to get too bogged down in that. We can talk more on that. The following is from Roger Walsh, who's a psychologist and a Buddhist meditator. He says, myths are grand stories that portray in an imaginative and symbolic manner the basic mental structures, understanding, and worldview created by a culture and which in turn create and maintain that culture. As such, myths seem to be essential to the cultural coherence and well-being, and much of our contemporary confusion may reflect the fact that our culture is between myths. Ideally, myths complement and harmonize with other modes of knowing and explanation, such as rational knowledge and transrational wisdom. However, problems arise when symbolic myths are not recognized as such, but are mistaken for empirical facts or linear logic. And I think that it can apply to pre-modern versions, certainly creationism as I understand it, and certain modern versions, Darwinism has evolved. It's been refined. I'm not an expert. I'm a generalist in this area. But it has been refined. He published The Origin of the Species in 1859. So I just want to wrap this up with, I want to put just some other ideas on the table, and we may or may not explore them, but in the postmodern area, there is a new world mythos coming out. Science is part of it. And just to finish my comments then, what I see in the pre-modern version is that consciousness, with a capital C, is present in that creation story. And it's dealing with what happened before the Big Bang. In the modern era, we're dealing with our empirical, analytical research models with only body and mind. I mentioned body, mind, and spirit before. This is the perennial great chain of being. And it's a pre-modern idea that comes down to us. And it got lost in the modern era. So what I'm arguing is missing in the modern era in science, in the science of evolution, is a theory of consciousness with a small c. Let's not even get to the big C yet, with a small c. And so what's emerging in postmodern thinking is emergence of consciousness from pre-modern eras with body and mind. So if we have spirit articulated and it comes to us, however it comes to us, it is not present in the evolutionary models. And I'm arguing that with proper care, and it takes a lot of care and subtle exploration, that we can bring these together in a postmodern way that applies to science. It's actually bridging science and religion, as Chris was mentioning, and it's a big issue. There's a lot of work going on. And I will end my comments there. Thank you.
I'm going to use. By the way, I'm Dan. He's Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dan.
Chris. But that's all right. It's a compliment either way. So I guess bases are loaded. I don't know how many outs we have.
A couple, maybe.
And I'm not a.
You had runners on third and second.
I don't know why they've got me hitting cleanup, because in my baseball days I was known for my bunting and base stealing. So I think you better sharpen your spikes. And we're going to go for the most dangerous play in baseball, which is known as the suicide squeeze. A bunt with the bases loaded. You ready? All right. Let's see. You know, this whole debate between the idea of creationism and evolution, I mean, it's one of those that I have personally always sat out, because I rank it right up there with polarized issues like abortion versus adoption. We could enumerate many of them. I just stay out of them. They can absorb so much energy. They're so tangled. There's so many layers and levels to them. You know, I take those pitches, I guess. I don't swing. So, and as it turns out, I am a teacher. I'm the one here that actually every day I teach children. Sometimes I teach them science. Sometimes I teach them religion. But actually, in my personal experience, the issue doesn't come up, because my school is an independent school. We don't get a dime from the government other than for food. And so, you know, no one dictates what we can or can't teach. So I can talk to kids about anything. I can teach them Bible stories if I want. You know, and we don't have to separate church from state in our school. God's welcome in our school all the time if we want God to be welcome. So, again, I don't have to deal with it. I know it's a very powerful issue. It's politically charged. It has tremendous implications, and it deserves a lot of attention by all of us. But again, I guess I'm kind of going to sit it out. Personally, I've actually been doing a lot of reading recently about evolution as part of research for a book that I'm working on that really has nothing to do with science at all. It has to do with children. And what I'm discovering is that scientists that are, you know, way out on the edge right now, and these are biologists, these are chemists, these are evolutionary theorists. To the best of my understanding, what they are coming up, what they're beginning to see, is that, you know, Newton was wrong, Darwin was wrong, to the extent that what all of us are seeing right now, and what's going on inside each of us, inside our consciousnesses, it's not a machine. It's, you know, Newton's image of the universe was that it was a giant, it was like a wound-up watch, and that everything was going to work exactly so in a sort of cause and effect pattern. And almost anything could be predicted. And even humans were an ultimate product of that process. And today, scientists are saying, no, it doesn't. There's got to be something more there. There is something more there. And actually, even Darwin's theories, as far as he took them, they really don't adequately explain human creativity. They don't explain human consciousness at all. Well, that's what they're saying, that they don't. And I have some sympathy there. You know, interestingly, there was a contemporary of Darwin. Did you know about Alfred Russel Wallace?
He was Darwin's invisible shadow.
Right.
Came up with the same theory at the same time.
At the same time. He was actually a little ahead of Darwin. Mm-hmm. He was ahead of Darwin. This was another naturalist, very similar to Darwin, very similar, well, different background. He was a working class guy, but they were very much on the same track. It's kind of that 100th monkey kind of thing. They were seeing the same thing at the same time, but working separately. And Wallace didn't have the ambition that Darwin had. So ultimately, Wallace just started giving Darwin his information and saying, great, you know, you published the big book. I'm okay with that. Well, that's the way it happened. And as a result, Wallace kind of just faded into history. I'd never learned about him until a couple of years ago. He wasn't in any of my history textbooks in college and high school and so on. But what happened with Wallace, once he had pretty much seen the same thing that Darwin had seen, is he ended up being very frustrated, because when he began looking at human instincts and human consciousness and creativity, he just didn't see that just those principles of mutation and natural selection were enough to explain, you know, how all of what humans are got here. He just felt this deep sense of something was missing. He wasn't sure what it was, but for him there had to be something more that was kind of, in a sense, behind the process, behind this great developmental thing that's happening, where we're just getting more complex and complex and complex. What Wallace ended up doing was going to seances. He became part of he went searching into the spiritualist movement that was going on at the time. And he didn't find what he was looking for there. He died without finding what he was looking for. But my reading of the latest stuff is that that's kind of what they're coming to. So I don't know. I'm not a scientist.
With your permission,
go ahead.
I just cannot contain myself.
Go for it, baby. Run.
Richard Dawkins has written a book called River Out of Eden, which is written for the intelligent layman who wants to know something about Darwinism, and I commend it to you. In it, he talks about this kind of cultural relativism that the two of you are espousing, in which we can't really be sure of anything, and it may all be existing on a plane that we haven't guessed at yet. And he says that people who don't believe in hard science on the ground find that they do believe in it when they're at 30,000 feet in a 757. Because then they want to know all about fuel and burn rates and jet engines and gravity and airflow over the wings and whether the pilot has good radar and whether there is snow where they're going to land. And then when they land, they can again go back to their mystical notions about the puzzlement of reality. Wallace is actually very well known, and there's a brand new biography of him that came out. And actually, the ideas that Darwin and Wallace came up with were very much current at the time. The problem both of them had was that they were afraid to draw the ultimate conclusion, which was, in Darwin's case, his theory led inescapably to the possibility that man was not created by God, but was created by evolution, just like everyone else. And he never put this into print because he didn't want to offend his wife, a devout Presbyterian. But he did believe it, and he put it into his journals. Can I say one more thing? Thank you. The question that Wallace had has been wonderfully summarized by Dawkins as the argument for personal incredulity, which is what he opposes to the argument for design. And this argument goes as follows. I can't understand how that could happen, therefore it couldn't have happened. And when somebody says, how could the eye evolve without knowing that there could be an eye or that there was anything to see? What they are actually saying is, I can't believe that it could. And what they are making is not a scientific statement, but an autobiographical revelation. And the answer to them is, okay, we now know that you can't understand how that could happen. The fact is, the eye was such a no-brainer that it's been evolved 40 different times in 40 different ways among beings that are alive right now. Eyes are very easy to evolve, take about 400,000 generations, and that's all. A snap of time.
No, the science that I'm referring to is not mystical at all. It is hard science. It's work being done by microbiologists. Part of Darwin's limitation was that he mostly studied large mammals. I mean, that's all he had available to him. He didn't have the technology we have today to...
To say flowers, ferns, birds.
He did, but
fish,
a lot of the survival of the fittest stuff. It came from his study of large animals. He couldn't study at the micro level. He didn't have the technology to study it with. And what microbiologists are discovering is that there's just a tremendous intelligence. The intelligence that Wallace was looking for is simply built into the evolutionary process itself. It's not outside of it. It's inside of it. And it's always been inside of it from the moment it all began. And that's just, it's I see that as kind of a unifying principle.
They're okay.
So, I obviously don't believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible. I just have the sympathy I have with the creationist concern and parents' concerns when they send their kids off to public school every day is that, you know, life isn't just a machine. There is something else to it. And I think scientifically we're growing out of that paradigm that life is just a machine and that everything can just be explained in terms of what can be measured and pieced together by chains of cause and effect. And so I have that sympathy. And I think, you know, we're just not done. There's so much we don't know. Hard science that we don't know. There's work being the work that's going on now, and more of it's got to be done. And I think we are in a shifting time. And I for one, I'm not a scientist. I don't know exactly where it's leading, but I think it's actually pretty exciting. Thank you.